I am so goddamn excited to jump into this subject with you, Fallon. I mean, holy shit, did you serve up a real smoker?
Badass woman pilot, like, come on.
I intend to come all over this thing. It's gonna be a real mess in here. History, I'd like to follow me down the rabbit hole. History, I'd like to, frankly, I want to know. Hi, welcome to HILF. History, I'd like to fuck with Dawn Brody. I'm Dawn Brody, and thanks for joining me in The Den. That's the Deluxe Edition Network. To find your next favorite podcast in The Den, click the link in our show notes or go to deluxeeditionnetwork.com. Now, today, we are in the cockpit with legendary aviatrix Amelia Earhart. Now, she rose to fame in the 1920s as one of the first female pilots, and you can probably picture her, right, just smiling and waving in one of the many newsreels telling of her daring exploits. You know, the first woman to fly across the Atlantic, the first person to fly to Hawaii. I mean, she broke records and hearts around the world. And then one day in 1937, in the midst of yet another adventure, she vanished. Now on board with us today is the incredible Fallon Morey, a researcher and co-host on the podcast That's So Fucked Up, TSFU, with Ashley Richards. And she's so smart and she's so funny, and it is a joy to have you along as we all go down together. Let's get started. I want to introduce you, of course, first. Many of my listeners may already be, you know, hearing a sound of familiarity because you yourself are in the podcast sphere. You are a researcher and a occasional co-host for That's So Fucked Up.
That's right. Yeah, I started as a researcher and now I'm kind of like the regular, most of the time, co-host with Ashley Love Richards on That's So Fucked Up. And it's been a wild, fun ride. But yeah, so that's where you can find me normally.
And tell me what brought you to That's So Fucked Up, because I know you have a research background and a history background. How did they get you?
I'm also super into like weird cults. And so, you know, sometimes you wake up in the morning and you're like, I want to hear about this random topic that I have never, ever thought of today. And I think that day I was like, let me research Hillsong Church. I don't know why.
Wow.
It just like popped into my head and I found their episode first that they had just done. And then I listened to, I don't know, like 50 episodes. And Ashley messaged me one day and was like, thanks for joining our Instagram.
And here you are.
Yeah. And then I heard you on the Valentine's episode when you were on with Ash and found HILF and then listened to like all of HILF. And I met you when you did Jonestown, I think.
Right? Mm-hmm. Wow, that guy. If you have not yet heard me as a guest on That's So Fucked Up, go to the show notes. I'll have a link to it so you can dig in on that. It is, wow, was Jim Jones, just terrible, terrible ideas, but excellent sideburns. So,
and we tried to get Dawn, well, I didn't try. I just listened to Ash try to get Dawn to join our cult for 4 episodes.
She did, and I was like,
I did
like,
the
no.
editing, so I was like, wow, would you stop? I'm getting uncomfortable. No.
I know, and don't tell Ashley this, but I will 100% join her cult if she asks me again. She was one ask away from me going tits first into that one. I would have done it.
I mean, that's why they ask you so many times, because they know you're always one away.
You assigned me the absolute smoke show, Amelia Earhart. Can you tell me why and how this fantastic subject has come to our doorstep?
Well, I'm just, you know, I was a woman in the military myself once upon a time. And I'm so enthralled with badass women in history. So I was in the Navy for like 14 years. I got out in there right out of college and I served on kind of big ships and stuff. So Being one of just a few as a woman in the Navy is, you know, was never like the easiest job in the world. Mm-hmm. So I've always really looked up to like super strong women.
I want to tell you, first of all, about the sources, because Amelia Earhart is one of these figures in history where we are not short on resources of information about her life. She, you know, was one of the biggest celebrities on the face of the planet at the same time that we started to get really good at photography and radio and video recording. And so there's a lot of captured images of her. I would be surprised if the people listening cannot immediately picture what Amelia Earhart looks like in their head. In fact, she is sort of synonymous, not just with pilots, but with the first pilots, with women pilots. You see the little leather hat, the goggles.
The cute short haircut and the leather bomber jacket. You definitely think Amelia Earhart, even if you don't know who she is.
So you know basically the era just because she's so aesthetically locked into that 20s, 30s aesthetic. You know, feminist icon. And then maybe you have the you know, pop culture image of like Amy Adams at Night at the Museum. And you're like, okay, this, you know, generally sort of encompasses my knowledge of Amelia Earhart.
Yep, that's me. And I love history. I was a history major too, and I have never strangely looked into Amelia Earhart, so she's snuck under my radar as well.
And she's also got mystery, man. I mean, in addition to wanting to come at this subject because it's just so historically fascinating, she's cool, it's first, it's flight, is the room for conspiracy and conjecture and guessing. And as you and I are recording this, we are only a few weeks away from a huge announcement in the world of Amelia Earhart history, because there's a company that thinks they might have finally found her plane.
What?
Crazy.
What? That's amazing. Perfect timing.
Oh, man. So I have, this book was my primary source. This is Amelia Earhart. It's a biography by historian Doris L. Rich. It's just a fantastic biography. She, Doris Rich, is a particularly great source of history, not only because she's a woman, but because she has interest in aviation and because she was a little girl when Amelia Earhart was rising. And so she sort of has a way to like speak to what it was like to live in a world that was dominated by the news of her, and to live in a world that felt in the present the loss of her. It's a great source. And then, as I said, sister, sit down. You can watch plenty of footage of Amelia Earhart walk and talk and fly in her beautiful clothes, her weird marriage. Man, I'm going to get into all that stuff. It's going to be...
Oh, God, I'm so ready.
I know, right? I hope you have a cocktail, Fallon. Do you have a drink? Do you have a coffee? Do you have some sort of caffeination?
I do. I always have a caffeine and another water, you know. They call it like the ADHD trifecta. There's like a beverage for hydration, a beverage for energy, and a beverage for enjoyment. So I've got my few.
I like that. If you were Amelia Earhart or one of these early aviatrixes, which, welcome to your new favorite word, aviatrix, like, yeah. They'd have a little can of tomato juice. So I feel like when we get to our break, you and I can both, like, just in solidarity with the aviatrixes, just like slam a can of tomato juice. Well, Fallon, here's my plan for the Hilfing of Amelia Earhart. Okay, this is my flight plan going forward. We're gonna take off very traditionally from Amelia Earhart's childhood. All right, we're gonna circle around the daddy issues, kind of gather up all of those early inspirations. Then we're gonna puddle jump, basically kind of land, come in for brief landings on like islands of interest, right, along the way in her story, the stuff that I think is just the most toe-curling and the most fascinating parts. We're going to meet some of her buddies. We're going to find out about her lovers, if any, and the crazy nuts stuff, like when she performed live on stage with Groucho Marx. What?
What?
Okay, then we're going to celebrate some victories. We're going to share some of her defeats. And then, oh, God, we're going to climb aboard with her. And on that doomed flight, and we're going to follow her not only through her famous demise, but I'll go ahead and circle around some of those theories about what happened to her after her mysterious disappearance.
It sounds amazing. I'm so ready. I'm strapping in, Tsar.
She's got a barf bag and a seatbelt and these adorable little hat. She's ready to go. Our Hilfing of Amelia Earhart begins with a story that takes place on a lovely spring day in May of 1932 in the city of Londonderry, which is in Northern Ireland, all right, right on the coast. And the Gallagher family owns this huge farm, and they're sitting out in their garden. It's a very lovely day. And they start to hear the sound of an airplane. And they see an airplane flying kind of low over their property. And it's bizarre. Now, they've seen planes before. It's very rare. And then this fucking thing lands in a little field next to their house. What? Okay. So the men run out to this plane. Like, what the hot hell is this? And oh my God, a pilot climbs out the door. And then, oh my God, this pilot is a girl. Holy hot. And she's cute. She's got jostled blonde hair. She's wearing this great leather jacket. She doesn't seem, according to them, to be, quote, at all excited.
She's like, meh.
Yeah. And she, yeah, exactly. They're like, where did you come from? And she says, America. And can I use your telephone? I have to call my husband and tell him I made it.
Oh, my God.
The reason why I wanted to start just with that incredible moment in that story is because as we move forward, I just want us to have our arms around how fucking face-meltingly futuristic and unfathomable this shit was to the people at the time, right? The first airplane was in 1903. The first time anyone on Earth had ever even seen anything like an airplane was 34 years ago. It's so new.
Wow. So it's possible these guys have never seen an up-close airplane before. And they are just, you know, wow. They're just like blown away. Like, what is in my cornfield?
Right. Absolutely. Now, these folks, like I said, they would have known what an airplane is, but you're 100% right. There is a huge chance that this was the first airplane any of them had seen. Right. And this is the future is now. It's borderline supernatural. I mean, the way that I kind of imagined it is it's like in the 1980s. If Michael Jackson stopped to use your bathroom, it's just like, what? But there was a quote in one of the documentaries that described both Charles Lindbergh and Amelia Earhart as feeling like gods from outer space. It's hard, I think, especially this far into the future with the technology that we take in stride, to just kind of completely understand the awe that these people and these feats inspired, you know, at the time. I'm going to give you just a little whirlwind of the Earhart family drama because it's, you know, you pick up a biography of one of these figures in history and I'm tempted, of course, to just flip to the end and be like, what was it like the day she disappeared? And I get a little, like a lot of people with history, I don't want to waste time talking about, she was a young girl in Kansas and she really loved to sled. It's like, fucking get to the fingering in college.
Something Amelia Earhart was famous for. No, I doubt that. But
right. No, exactly. But if she was, I want you to start with that.
If Amelia Earhart has like family drama and daddy issues, I feel better having daddy issues because like now I have something in common with Amelia Earhart.
Fallon, you nailed it. That's exactly why I do love to dig up the fuckable nuggets from these figures, is because it's very interesting and it does keep people coming back. But personally, it also does exactly that thing for you, which is like, oh my God, I have a huge gap between my teeth. I have sinus problems. There's no reason why I cannot make it the pages of history. You know, we can accidentally fill in the spaces with perfection when we only give our historical figures these lily pads, you know what I mean? So I do want to tell you a little about family drama because not only is it humanizing, but it's also really illuminating about questions that come up later about how was she able to do this and what motivated her. I think you find the trail in part with some of this stuff. So Amelia Earhart's mom is 16, right? Having this party at her house, and she's a very rich kid. Her dad, Amelia Earhart's grandfather, is a federal judge and he owns a bank and everyone's very wealthy. And this hot, handsome, penniless artist comes to the party, a guest of one of her older brothers. She falls immediately in love with this guy. And her dad is like, absolutely not. And puts a kibosh on it. And even though these two court each other and continue to confess their love to each other for 5 years, dad is like, hard no, he's too poor. Okay. And he won't even let them think about getting married until Amelia Earhart's dad can start earning $15 a month. He's like, if you can't make $15 a month, you cannot marry my daughter. And he works his ass off and he's finally able to like earn the money and they get married. And these grandparents are still throughout his whole life, like shitting on Amelia Earhart's dad for just being too low born and too poor.
Ugh. Her parents have, you know, wrong side of the tracks. Right side of the tracks.
Oh, absolutely. Directed by a Hughes. Yes. Yes. But it also tells you a little bit about how Amelia Earhart rolls, not only with love and romance, but with money. Because grandma and grandpa have an animosity towards her dad for her entire life, to the point where when her grandmother dies, she stipulates in her will that none of her millions can be given to her daughter until 25 years later or after her husband is dead.
Whoa.
Yeah. But also dad is, he's charming. He's impractical. He's impulsive. And it's part of the reason why Amelia Earhart's mom loved him. And it's also what draws Amelia to him. And this is one of the things that inspires her, that she makes really impulsive decisions. For example, during World War I, she goes to visit her younger sister who is living in Toronto. And she sees some of the returning men coming back from the war with the amputees and shell shock, and she sees the results of the war on these men, and she drops out of college and moves there and becomes a full-time nurse and just takes care of soldiers until the war is over.
Wow, that's incredible.
Mm-hmm. And then when the war is over and the 1918 flu pandemic starts, she stays and continues to work in the medical field until that goes away.
So I wonder how much of that sort of spirit she got from her dad, because she had the super hardworking, you know, like hardworking parents, even if she came from a little bit of money.
Exactly. And also the element of like, but you can't quit school. That wouldn't be convenient. And she's just sort of like, yeah, fuck it. Like, that's what everyone's saying. But like, that's not necessarily how we roll, you know. And it is her dad who takes her to see her first air show in St. Louis in 1920. Because dad, like I said, never really has any money. And when he does have a little money, he tends to blow it on stuff that makes him happy, which is, I mean, no notes from me.
Yeah, I mean, if blowing it on his daughter seeing her first airplane, it's, he had no idea what he was creating.
Totally. It was worth it. And she sees this air show, and these air shows in the 1920s, man, I mean, these planes were made of wood and fabric. And to get people interested in coming to these air shows, they would be walking on the wings. They'd be flying under bridges and just buzzing people, making it look like they were going to crash into the crowd and then pulling up at the last minute. I mean, it was like, it would draw your attention 100%.
Yeah. Like, maybe you'll go to the air show and maybe you'll die and maybe you won't.
It's going to be worth that 2 cents. I'll tell you that. So on Christmas Day, 1920, her dad takes her to another one of these shows because she's kind of digging it. And it's a new airfield in Long Beach. And it's this winter air tournament. And this is when she asks her dad about going up in a plane, that she would really like to do it. And so he finds a pilot. The guy's name is Frank Hawks in L.A. And he takes Amelia Earhart up in an airplane for the first time. And she comes home and she tells her family, and she writes this in her book. She says, I told my family after that I think I'd like to fly, knowing full well that I would die if I didn't.
Oh, I love that amount of passion about something. It just like stops my heart.
I do too. Mm. And that lust for flight is huge in Amelia Earhart. It seems obvious when you're talking about a figure like Amelia Earhart, like, oh yeah, Don, did she like to fly? That's fucking fascinating. Thanks for that insight. But there's a difference between wanting to fly, loving to fly, and having an obsession, having an addiction, an insatiable appetite. You know what I mean? These are slightly distinguishable things. The other thing that she's had since long before she got into that first plane with old Frank Hawks was a real love of what women were doing in the world. She had newspaper clippings and articles that she would cut out and keep in a book of women doing cool shit. And it didn't even have to be adventurous stuff. She would cut out someone, the first vice president of a bank, and she'd be like, fuck yeah, Helen. You know, she'd write in the margins, way to go, girl. And when she was looking for flying lessons, she tries to find a woman to teach her. And as luck would have it, she finds one, Fallon. Let me introduce you to Netta Snook.
What? I had no idea there was another. She had a woman teacher? I'm already. Wow.
Get out of here, right? So Netta Snook is working as a pilot. She's cute. She's crazy, of course. She takes sightseers out on, like, flights over the bay. In St. Louis, in LA, in, like, you know, going out over the ocean, showing sightseers around. And she's at the airfield one day and she sees Amelia Earhart walking towards her. And Amelia has this really imposing physical presence that you can go see for yourself, but is described consistently the same way. She's elegant. She's thin. She's tall. She wears really lovely clothes. She speaks with sort of a classy accent because, you know, her grandparents were really rich and she would spend long summers with her really rich parents. So she does have a way of moving as, like, an upper class educated woman, even though she was, her family was, like, constantly strapped for cash. And Netta Snook sees this slut walking across the airfield and she's like, yuck. She's like, this is going to be one of these rich cunts who just wants to ask me, what's it like to fly? Or, you know, I don't know. And she's just, yuck. And Amelia Earhart says, can you teach me to fly? And Netta says, yes, for $1 a minute, which is fucking expensive.
Whoa, that's like in, what was that, 1920, 1922?
Yeah.
Wow, that's a lot of money.
And Amelia's like, that sounds fair. Because why not? But it takes Netta Snook not long to realize that Amelia Earhart takes to this. She's obviously very, very good at it. And they become friends. She likes her. So these two become, friendly. And they're sharing airplanes. And they're sharing opportunities. And Amelia Earhart would have probably stayed as her, you know, co-pilot, or it's at least using Netta as an instructor, except Netta gets married and has babies and stops flying, which is exactly what happens to most of the women in Amelia Earhart's life. Either they themselves choose to stop flying after they get married and have babies, or their husbands forbid them from it because it is just way too dangerous. And this is, you know, kind of the time where Amelia starts to realize, like, I'm not, and she never seemed to have a huge draw for, like, love and family anyway, but she's sort of like, yeah, I can't do both. And I don't have any question about what I prefer.
If it's air or babies, I take the air. I take the fly.
There was no question in her mind. Amelia's like, I have to have my own plane. Like, there's no way that I'm going to continue to borrow, rent planes, use my instructor's plane. Like, I have to have my own plane. And she saves up her money by doing a ton of crazy jobs. She buys a construction truck and starts, like, working in construction sites with this giant truck to save money.
Say, when I was in my 20s, I saved up money for, like, a new bicycle still, or, like, maybe a janky car I could drive around, not like an airplane.
Totally. And she's like 20. Yeah, she's like 22, 23. And when she buys her first plane, it's a 17-foot wingspan.
Woo.
It has 60 horsepower, which is nothing. She loves it. She paints it yellow and calls it the Canary.
Aww, I love that.
I know, it's so cute. And she goes back to college and she... I mean, tell me anyone's cooler in this world. She flies to class sometimes. And there's like a student newspaper that calls her the student aviatrix and like her little yellow canary plant. Like, get the fuck out of here.
You are the coolest girl in school. Like, there's no one cooler.
100%. And then we hit kind of a rough spell. So she just personal bad luck. Her dad, you know, he can't be that handsome and that fun and that broke without also eventually becoming a drunk. It feels like it's a historical inevitability. Her parents divorce. She has this horrible reoccurring sinus problem that she actually got when she was working as a nurse during the flu epidemic. So she has like this like headaches and nasal problems. She has to go and get surgery all the time. She gets so broke, the money just disappears, and she has to sell her yellow plane. She has to sell the canary, which is so heartbreaking.
No, not the canary. I wonder if her like sinus issues were exacerbated by her flying.
Almost definitely. Now, at this point, Fallon, if I was talking about Netta Snook or any of the other, and we're going to meet a few other aviatrixes as we go, the story up to this point for Amelia Earhart isn't that unique. There are probably at this point a couple hundred women in America who are in lockstep with her. They love flying. They want to fly more. Maybe they have a plane. Maybe they don't have a plane. Maybe they're working on the engineering side, trying to like get new planes made. And there's a lot of competition among them for what few opportunities are there. And what sets Amelia Earhart in a different path, why we know her name and we don't know anyone else's. I mean, you know Netta Snook, but that's just because I just told you. Is because she gets a call and a job offer. And now, this is a part of the story that I call a sack of potatoes goes to England.
I'm intrigued.
So this guy, his name is George P. Putnam. He is a rich, bespeckled attention hog. Okay. He's Putnam of the Putnam Publishing Putnams. And he has two particularly famous clients. Yeah. You see, right? You know exactly who he is. He has two particularly huge clients. He has Charles Lindbergh, who is easily the most famous person on the face of the planet. Not just a famous pilot, but just a huge celebrity figure because he has flown the first solo Atlantic flight. And he did that from the time we're talking about just about a year prior to the time that Amelia Earhart gets this call. So it's still recent history. He is riding high. He's huge. And he wrote a book that Putnam published about that flight. And that book made a ton of money. And George P. Putnam also represents a guy named Richard Byrd, who is the world's foremost Arctic explorer. He flew over the North Pole in 1926. Everyone knows this guy's fucking name, right? And he wrote a book that Putnam published and made everybody a bunch of money. So George P. Putnam is like, okie doke, these girls be flying. Chances are one of these whores is going to be the first one to do something impressive. And when she is, I want to be the guy who not only manages her, but who publishes that book that will be such a bestseller.
Yeah. I'm sure he's just like looking for his next ticket. And he's like, female flyers. That's it.
Exactly. Exactly. And so George P. Putnam is using his contacts to try to see who is the most likely candidate. Are any of these women flyers kind of likely to emerge as the one? And how do we get in on that? How do we edge our bets? How do we, if nothing else, break the story first, right? And they catch wind of this woman named Amy Phipps Guest, who is the heir to a Pittsburgh steel fortune and the wife of a former British air minister. And they know about her because she bought a plane from Richard Byrd, the Arctic explorer. She's got one of his planes. And so Richard Byrd was like, knock, knock, knock. Hey, George Putnam, I think I know the slut who's going to try it because this plane she just bought can totally fly across the Atlantic. And she's from England, but she lives in Boston. So she's got a reason to do it. Let's all keep our eyes on Miss Guest. Okay. So they go to find her and they knock, excuse us, Miss Guest, are you possibly considering flying across the Atlantic? Are you thinking about being the first woman? And they're right. She says, yes, 100%. I did buy that plane because I want to fly it across the Atlantic. But my family put the kibosh on it because it's too dangerous. But what I am looking for is another woman to do it. Someone I can help fund.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for this woman to be the right woman for Miss Guest, she's like, this cannot be a feminist because they are gross. And she can't be a lesbian feminist because that's the grossest. And she, more importantly, really, than either of those things, she cannot look or act like a lesbian feminist. So someone who's tall, blonde, elegant, cool, soft-spoken, they're going to be an ideal candidate.
I was going to say, does she have a checklist of what lesbian feminists look like? Because
I mean, don't we all
know that? I don't know that I'd be able to just pick them out, right? Yeah.
And the press and the people were like very nervous about the wrong kind of woman and what some of these like scary feminists, you know what I mean, would be doing. At the same time, it was like, well, we do really want women to do it. We just don't want them to do it like bitches, you know. Among the things that makes Amelia Earhart the like perfect candidate for this is not, you know, and again, it's a smallish pool. So if they're looking then for someone to fit the bill for Miss Phelps, Phipps, you can just be like, well, there's only 20 women who own a plane. She's, you know, Amelia Earhart is only one of 17 women to have this international license. So eventually their eyes will land on her. And when they did, they were like, well, duh. I mean, this is our gal. She's perfect for all the ways we've already described. But then there's this added thing, which is Fallon. She has an uncanny resemblance to Charles Lindbergh. Like, this book talks about it so much and the newsreels talk about it so much that I thought they had to be trying to like promote this or something. But if you look at these two next to each other, it is an uncanny resemblance.
Yeah, they look like they could be like siblings, right? Like brother, sister.
Totally. And eventually they're like, yeah, this girl's totally the deal. And here, Fallon, is the offer. This flight is going to go across the Atlantic. Amelia Earhart is not flying this plane. This is 1928, and she is going to make history, Fallon, as being the first woman to ride in an airplane across the Atlantic.
Whoa.
I didn't appreciate that at the time, but everything I'm about to tell you is about her simply being the first woman to sit in the plane that went across the Atlantic. They're like, you just sit there, sister. You're the sack of potatoes going to England. There's going to be three people on this plane. There's going to be the pilot. His name is Wilmer Stultz. Totally. He gets 20 grand for doing this. Then he has a mechanic named Lewis Gordon. He's going to get 5 grand for doing it. You're going to sit there and ride. And when they land in England, they're going to take pictures. You're going to be the first woman to have ever flown the Atlantic. And it's going to be a huge deal.
I can't imagine the like disheartening like for her. She's like, yes, I get to do this incredible thing I've always dreamed of. But really, you just want me to look pretty in the back of an airplane. Wow. How insulting.
Yes, of course. And it's more than that. Not only do they say you're not going to fly, you're going to write stories. We're still going to make you write a book and publish all this stuff. And all the money from that goes into the, quote, general fund, which I don't understand exactly. But she didn't get paid for it, is the bottom line. And she says, okay, you know what? I will absolutely do this if, one, I get to check all of the equipment and I get to meet the pilot and agree on who pilots it. And two, I do want to fly some, like after we get to Europe, I want to fly in Europe a little bit.
Yeah.
Right. And they're like, okay, let's do it. Now, let's not forget that this trip across the Atlantic has not been successfully completed since Lindbergh did it the year before. 14 people had tried and died.
Whoa.
And 3 of the people who had tried and died were women. So it isn't really accurate to say she was just a sack of potatoes. Like, this is still one of the most dangerous things any human being can do. And the fact that a woman is putting herself in this dangerous situation is part of the reason why people are so excited for her, you know? And she is, Fallon, fully aware of how dangerous it is. Not only does she write goodbye letters to everyone in her family, but she writes poetry about her feelings. And I'm going to read you a little bit of one of those poems right now. Courage is the price that life exacts for granting peace. The soul that knows it not knows no release from little things.
Wow. You can just like hear how like desperate she is to get in the air and just she's ready to just say goodbye to anything to get like that little piece of her dream. That's I got chills.
This one I love. It's what she writes to her dad. Keep in mind, her dad's the one that is sort of credited with putting that spark of adventure in her heart, right? She says to her dad, quote, "Hooray for the grand adventure. I wish I had won, but it was worthwhile anyway. You know that. I have no faith we'll meet anywhere else, but I wish we might. Anyway, goodbye and good luck to you."
Aw, that's so sweet. I think today, if Amelia Earhart took off, it would be like a text. People write such crap letters now. It'd be like a text, like, "See you in a couple days when I get to England."
Yeah, TY with like the hang loose hand.
Later.
So she gets these letters, you know, tucked away to her family. And then she and Stultz and Gordon get on the plane. They're going to take across the Atlantic, but they don't go across the Atlantic right away. Of course, they go to Nova Scotia, to the very, you know, furthest tip of North America. And they kind of wait there for the best weather to take off. And while they're waiting there for the best weather to take off, they run into a few problems. One is our guy Stultz, the fucking pilot, is a drunk, big drunk. And generally, whoa, when they have downtime, he's just wasted. Okay. Two, the weather sucks. So there's a lot of downtime for Stultz to get wasted because they're not leaving when they wanted to leave. And while they're sitting there in Nova Scotia on this top secret, like, am I going to be the first gal to get across the Atlantic? Another pilot, a gal named Mabel Ball, who's nicknamed the Diamond Queen, is like, "Hey girl, this is crazy. I'm with my plane up in Nova Scotia. No big deal." And so they're like, "Fuck, the slut's gonna scoop us." And so Amelia literally carries Stultz after a night of drinking to the controls and is like, "We're taking this hog into the air. Right now, we're all going to lose our shot." And on June 13th, the day after this Mabel had come to Nova Scotia, they take off. And 20 hours and 40 minutes later, they spot fishing boats and the port city of Buryport, Wales. They land in fucking Wales. She steps off the plane. Hot dog, the first woman to have ever ridden across the Atlantic. And bing, bang, boom, sister, she is almost immediately at the same level of fame as Charles Lindbergh. They come back to America. They get the ticker tape parade down Manhattan. They're on the cover of everything. Everyone wants a piece of them. George P. Putnam is just dancing. He got his papers and his book rights. And it's, you know, that alone would have marked her in the history books. But as you and I both know, we do not remember Amelia's name because she rode along on a trip across the Atlantic.
No, not at all. That was so surprising to hear that. I had no idea that she didn't actually pilot the plane herself. That I'm like blown away.
The fact that the first time that she made history, it was as a passenger, I think is a significant part of this story. It does tell us not just about the person, but the time she lived in. And she's not happy with it either. She's incredibly humble. She, anytime people are like, "Holy shit, you were the first woman to write," she's like, "He did the flying and he did the navigating and I was just there." And she gets a little, and she's feeling it, I think, personally too, like that wasn't the thing. And so she begins at this point to really contemplate, what is she going to do next that will fill her heart with that sense that she has done something that matters to her? And that is what we're going to talk about when we come back.
This podcast is part of the Deluxe Edition Network. To find other great shows on the network, head over to deluxeeditionnetwork.com. That's deluxeeditionnetwork.com.
Welcome to Sorta Kinda Funny. We're a comedy podcast.
Brother and sister duo.
Where we take your guys' embarrassing moments and stories and turn them into humor. Because life's about laughing at yourself. And we are sure going to laugh at ourselves. I am James. I am your main Mac Daddy host. And I'm also joined by a loser. Go ahead. Wow. Introduce yourself, loser. Go ahead. Don't be shy.
This is Lauren.
Give it to them.
Absolutely. Baby. Absolutely. What did you say?
Also, we sing a lot. So if you haven't listened to this first episode, I'm sorry.
We have new episodes available every Thursday and would love nothing more than to hang out with you. Does that sound too desperate?
Yes.
Okay. Check us out wherever you listen to your podcasts and we'll see you on Thursday. And as always,
text me if you want to hang out.
Bye.
Before we climb back into the cockpit with Amelia, a moment for those who keep me flying high, my patrons. The latest on my landing strip are Janine G, David P, and Meredith B. These physically attractive and intellectually astute individuals keep my gears lubricated and provide the pitch and yaw I need to bring these hilfs in for a successful landing again and again. If you are not yet among their honorable ranks, check out What's What at patreon.com/hilfpodcast. Then head over to Instagram and... Fallon, we are back from our break, and where we left our girl Amelia Earhart, she had just kind of emerged onto the international scene as notable, not only because she was one of few women pilots on Earth, but because she was the only woman who had ridden in an airplane across the Atlantic. And again, to just highlight how fucking nuts and a different time and place this was, that just being a passenger on a plane like that would have gotten her a ticker tape parade and endorsement deals, man. And, you know, all the exciting things celebrities get.
Right. I mean, I think the majority of people at her age are supposed to be like in a house with some kids and a husband. And she just stepped off a friggin' airplane. I mean,
yeah, she is like Cher, Michael Jackson, and Elon Musk all rolled into one.
I don't know if I'd put Elon Musk in there, but
only because he went to Mars. He's trying to get to outer space. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. That's right.
And Amelia Earhart at this point too, she doesn't really love the fame. I mean, if you watch any of the footage of her, you can tell that she is not exactly rolling around in it. She's enduring it. She's demure and she's passive. It's exciting, but you can tell this is not exactly where she wants to be. She always smiles with her lips closed because she's got a little gap between her teeth. She's self-conscious about her skin because she's sunburned all the time from just like, you know, sitting in her plane and the wind and everything. And, you know, this is her, but she knows she's got to do it if she wants to keep flying. It's transactional for her, and she seems to completely understand the deal.
Yeah, and she's not doing it because she wants the fame. Conversely to, like, probably most people, she's doing it because she just wants to fly.
Totally.
Get me in that plane. I don't want any of this shit.
Absolutely. Yeah. And she understands, too, in the real modern sense, how these deals work. Because in August of 1928, her George P. Putnam, you know, working with a bunch of people in the industry and in, you know, sort of shared interests around her, is like, okay, here's the deal, man. We're going to give you a plane. And we're going to have you fly it around the United States so that you can promote the possibility, of course, for someday commercial air travel, and also to get women into flying, which would be great. And then even when we can't get women to fly, let's see if we can get these sluts to stop telling their husbands not to fly.
It's an on-the-ground campaign. Yeah,
right. And this is when she takes the first Trans-America, right, cross the entire United States flight, and she does it with this plane that they give her. And they said, you know, we want you to go and promote. And she says, that's fine, but I decide when I go and I decide where I go. She's tired of all of the micromanaging. And she tells George P. Putnam, I absolutely will take this free plane, thanks so much, and I'm going to fly it all over hell, but I don't want anyone telling me what to do. And he agrees to that only because the press follows her organically wherever she goes. He doesn't have to like orchestrate these stops and make sure that a big crowd is going to be there because it's just naturally happening. And she is wonderfully, you know, exploiting these opportunities. And she gets for example, a writing job with Cosmo and this airline agency called the TAT, the Transcontinental Air Transport Commission. They're like, here, we'll give you money to just get people to keep flying.
Ugh, but I was going to say, Amelia, like, work it, girl. Like, do things on your own terms. I love this.
Absolutely. Like, if I want to go to Vegas, I'm going to Vegas. And if I want to stop in the mountains, I'm going to stop in the mountains. I want to start with, like, kind of a good morning 1929. The roaring 20s are almost over. You know, Amelia Earhart is household name. She now has accomplished not just that transatlantic passenger flight, but she's also crossed the United States in a plane she fucking flew herself. And every time she lands or crashes into somebody's yard or makes some kind of appearance, people's faces are melt and their hair blows back. And
she's like the Metallica of female celebrities.
Nailed it, Fallon. That's exactly right. And there's just panties. Yeah, panties are flying at her from every stand. It's remarkable. Unknowingly, of course, everybody is inching towards the month of October, which is when the Great Depression starts, the bottom drops out for everybody, and anyone who had a little money laying around, which they probably didn't, does not have it anymore. And planes flying, this stuff is now fewer and farther between. There's more competition. It's painful.
Right. Because everyone who had money was, you know, pushed to invest for a couple of years. So all this old money is sort of like what you watch it just flush down the drain.
Absolutely. Right? And things that people would consider risky investments, they're just not going to invest in the future of a possible commercial aircraft. Then her dad dies.
No.
I know. Edwin dies. And this is the part of the story that I call crash into me. Because if you recall the story that I opened our history with, she climbs out of that plane in Londonderry and says, can I use your phone? I have to call my husband and tell him I made it. And you'll recall I've said that, like, she's not getting married. She's not having anybody's babies.
No. So where's the husband come in?
Exactly. So it is in 1929 that George P. Putnam asks Amelia Earhart to marry him the first time.
Oof. I was not expecting that.
Yeah. He was already married, sister. He had had a wife of 15 years and they had a couple of kids. And then he divorces this wife. She gets married to someone else like 3 weeks later and he proposes to Amelia Earhart. And Amelia Earhart is like, hard pass, buddy. You should be aware of the fact that I'm not fucking any of these guys. And I'm around a ton of men and I'm not having babies and I'm not courting anyone. And I've said, I'm not doing that. He continues to ask her to marry him 6 times over the next 2 years. Now, keep in mind where we are right now, the stock market crash, dad dies, she has no money, she has nowhere to fly. And what appears to have happened is that George P. Putnam and Amelia Earhart came to an understanding on what a marriage between them would be like.
So not in the traditional sense, but we kind of need to do this. You need me. I need you.
And this is not pure speculation on my part, because she handwrites a letter to him that she gives him on their wedding day, February 7th, 1931. And that letter says to him, quote, I shall not hold you to any medieval code of faithfulness, nor shall I consider myself bound to you similarly. Please don't let us interfere with the other's work or play, or let the world see our private joys or disappointments. I may have to keep some place where I can go to be by myself now and then, for I cannot guarantee to endure at all times the confinement of even an attractive cage.
Wow. Talk about some progressive ideas.
Oh, it's awesome. She goes on then to tell him, "I must exact a cruel promise, and that is that you will let me go in a year if we find no happiness together. I will try to do my best in every way and give you that part of me you know and seem to want."
Whoa. Wow. Call it like it is, but I can imagine her like handing him this letter and being like, "Great, just tuck that in your lapel. Say you agree to it. Great, let's go. Go down the aisle."
Exactly. This is a question too I had, which is, and it's come up at various times in some of the other histories I've researched, which is, I think, a kind of natural curiosity about the nature of other people's relationships, you know, like, were they really in love and what was the deal there? And even though she kind of lays it out in that letter, nonetheless, they're joining their lives together. They are deliberately deciding to be a family, you know? And even though she never has any children, he has a couple of kids and she's close with his sons. They look up to her. They speak well of her forever. And there's a couple of other moments like this. There's a time where she lands in Detroit for some public appearance and she crashes. It's not an elegant landing. She kind of makes a big spectacle in front of these crowds. And G.P. Putnam runs out to the plane so fast that he trips. He breaks a rib and an ankle and he ends up going to the hospital and she's completely fine.
Oh, my God. I mean, there are different kinds of love, though. I mean, I think we have this notion based on the time we live in, like what love is or supposed to be. But I think it's totally fair to say that they had some type of love, even if it's not what every person would call, you know, like the right type in our relationships.
Love is love, man. I don't know what they agreed to, and it's not really a lot of my business. They're consenting adults who agreed on it. There is a lovely moment where a housekeeper said that she saw GP and Amelia out the window one time. They liked to garden together. There was a garden on their property. And she saw him pushing Amelia around in a wheelbarrow. And they're just both laughing and playing together. And like, I don't know, that's enough for me.
Yeah.
I want you to buckle up, girl, because we're getting back in the air with Amelia here. Because if you remember when we talked about the thing that had made her the most famous first was riding along on the trip to the Atlantic. And then she crisscrossed the United States, which was very cool and increased her fame. But she's still not sitting right. She's like, "I want to fly across the Atlantic and I want to do it like Lindbergh did alone." And no one has done it since. And this one is huge. And she knows this is huge. And not only because she's already done a huge history making thing, but because she intends to be the first woman to fly solo across the Atlantic with her fucking hands on the controls this time. And she takes off across the Atlantic. And Fallon, this fucking flight, the first 4 hours, she is in a violent electrical storm. Whoa. A weld breaks in the manifold of her plane, which basically shoots flaming exhaust from underneath the plane for the remainder of the journey. Her altimeter broke, so she has no idea of knowing how high or low she is when she's flying over the ocean at night. In order to avoid waves and weather, she just goes up. She just starts heading up until her gauges start to freeze and ice forms over her devices. And then she goes down until she sees fucking water. And then she goes up again until her gauges freeze. And then she goes down again until, I mean, it's nuts. There's gas fumes coming into the plane. She's choking. She's afraid she's going to lose consciousness. And when she goes to flip her gas from one fuel tank to the other, she realizes the fuel gauge is not only broken, so she doesn't actually know how much fuel she has. She can feel gasoline dripping down her neck.
Oh my God. My heart is like pounding. I'm like actually like a little nervous right now.
I know. And she nuts. It's nuts. And this is the condition that our girl lands in, that field that we opened the story with, the Gallagher farm, when they're like, "What the fuck? You came from America?" I mean, that was the, It was an absolutely harrowing, like, sister earned her wings on this one, is what I'm saying.
Yeah. So, but she still walks off the plane, like, completely unbothered. Like, what's up, guys? Just, you know, almost died crossing the Atlantic. You got a phone?
I have to call my husband. Yeah. Amelia, at this point, man, she is the celebrity that she was before, but even more so. And from this point, over the next 5 years, she continues to accomplish a series of amazing things. She, from the beginning, has been giving lectures and speeches and appearances. She's pushing really hard for a female draft.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, because, you know, we're between world wars at this point, and she is an avowed pacifist, but she believes and says repeatedly, if we are going to war, then we're all going to war, and there should be no separation among the sexes as to who does what.
Which is also a super progressive, obviously, opinion of the time. And I'm wondering if the other women were like, shut up, Amelia. We don't want to go to war. You go to war.
Yeah. But it's not just that. She's also breaking speed records. She's breaking distance records. On her press tour, she breaks a speed record. And she's lifting up other women. She is endorsing women for jobs. She is bringing little known women along with her just to share some of the attention that she's getting. She's advocating for, you know, women's organizations. She's she comes up with a fashion line of wrinkle-free, sort of stretchy activewear. You know, who doesn't want to look like Amelia Earhart? It's a very nice look. She's writing books. She's got luggage. She's helping people organize commercial airlines. You know, like, yeah, let's get, and in her work organizing commercial airlines, she's like, I think we should have a strong Department of Transportation. And some of her colleagues are like, no, there should be a department just for airline. I mean, she's just kicking ass in a number of areas.
And probably one of the most famous people, right? Like, in the country at the time, I would imagine.
Easy. By January of 1935, Amelia Earhart, check it out. This is her like little resume of accomplishments up to this point. She's the first person to fly solo from Honolulu to California in either direction of any sex. She is the first person to cross the Atlantic twice now in an airplane. She's the first woman to fly it solo. She's the first woman to fly this plane called an autogrid. And she's the first woman to make a solo crossing of the continent. She did this incredible LA to Mexico to New York flight that had then connected the continent. And could she have stopped there? Maybe. Should she have stopped there? It's arguable. And when she's asked, why are you doing this? Especially when she's criticized. Are you doing this for personal fame? Are you doing this for the pineapple growers in Hawaii? Are you doing this for Cosmopolitan? She said, I am doing this to make it clear, I love this, that women like to do such things and can.
Oh, there it is, my hero.
All right, now I want you to girdle your heart.
I know. I knew this was coming, and it still doesn't make it easier.
I know. I mean, and if I've done my job, you're in love with her now.
Oh.
And it's 1937. It's been 5 years since her last huge flight, that solo crossing across the Atlantic. Her fucking plan, and she's talked to GP about it, and she's written it down, is she wants to be the first human being to fly a plane around the entire planet at the equator. So the widest part, clearly.
Yeah, the widest part. I'm assuming with stops, right?
Yep, there's going to be a lot of stops, but that our route is going to take us in one plane with me as the pilot around this whole thing. And the plane that she selects is called the Lockheed. It's an Electra 10E. It's been modified a ton for this flight. the engineers, along with her and along with GP, have said, okay, we're going to give up this space in order to put fuel in this, you know, what seats, where seats would normally go, we're going to put gas tanks. We're going to make sure that we have all of the communication devices we need. So we're going to have something that can send Morse code, something that can, you know, send and receive radio, which means we have to put antennas in here. I mean, it's a pimp my plane situation.
Yeah. Wow, that was, and Lockheed is still a pretty big manufacturer of all kinds of things. But so it sounds like at this point she was like enough renowned to be supported in her adventure by more than just like, you know, just like a whim.
Totally. And she knows, and so does GP, how to get sponsors, right? Folks with complementary interests. And the plan is we're going to take this plane around the equator and we're going to go west, meaning she's going to leave California, go to Hawaii, go that way around the world until she comes back to the United States. She's not going alone. She knows she needs at least one navigator. But keep in mind, anytime you bring a person on board, that's weight that you could use for fuel. So it was always sort of, you know, and she's torn. There's these two great potential navigators, a guy named Harry Manning and a guy named Fred Noonan. Problem with Harry Manning is he's technically has more experience, is technically better at navigating and communication. But when they do testing with him, he doesn't test great. Like he doesn't get them where they're supposed to go when they're trying. They're like, maybe Manning isn't the guy. The better navigator, the better person for the job is a guy named Fred Noonan. And he is a drunk. Oh, no.
Why are they all drunks?
I know. You know what it is, Fallon? That's such a good question. It's because these test pilots are, a lot of them are drunks because they're just hurt and scared and broken all the time.
That's true. It's true.
You know, so she's like, OK, I don't need to pay. I'll bring them both. And then we'll just have both navigators. And then when we get into a situation where I can't have both on board, then we'll know which one to bring. And maybe one goes and comes, you know. So she's literally like, I don't want to pick one at this point. And part of the trick is that for that big leg over the Pacific, there would have to be a stop. So that means that she has to be able to land on an island. And the prevailing wisdom among all the people involved is that she's going to stop on this little atoll island in the Pacific called Howland Island. And the United States has, quote unquote, ownership of this island at the time. And it could use an airstrip. I mean, we don't know exactly what's going to happen with World War II, but why not have an airstrip that belongs to the United States in the middle of the Pacific? That could be handy. She's buddies with Eleanor Roosevelt, so she even pulls some strings to be like, it'd be soupy soupy if I could land my plane on this island.
Just call up my BFF Ellie and just like see what I can make happen.
Do it for all women, but do this for this woman. Yeah. Okay, so that's the plan. March 17th, 1937, Amelia Earhart gets in this beefed up Electra 10E with her navigators, Manning and Noonan. They take off, headed for Hawaii. Check, get to Hawaii. Easy peasy. Now we're going to fly from Hawaii to Howland Island, and then we're going to go on from there. And as they are taking off from Honolulu, they crash, sister, at takeoff. Big time. And that 10E, that Electra 10E is like totaled, man. So much so that they're like, okay, wait. And everyone goes home. And they take that plane to Pearl Harbor to get it fixed up. And everyone, and they got to figure out what they're going to do now. Because they got from Oakland to Hawaii and now it's done. This is how, oh no. And there's a point where Amelia goes to her friend, a gal named Jacqueline Cochran, who's also a pilot, very cool lady. And she's hanging out in her house and she's sitting crisscross applesauce in front of the fire with her friends. And they're talking about what to do next. And she says, well, aren't you guys going to tell me, get back on the horse? Don't give up. Keep going. And they all look at her and kind of shake their heads like, nah, girl, we think you should quit. We think this is kind of fucking nuts.
Wow.
Yeah. And they ask her, are you scared? Aren't you scared you're going to die? And she says, I love this quote. She says, as far as I know, I've got only one obsession, a small and probably feminine horror of growing old. So I won't feel completely cheated if I fail to come back.
Wow. Jesus. She's such a badass. Man, just at every turn.
Yeah. And she's like, and I'm not done. So she goes back. Now the fucking plane got fixed up and now it's June. So it's been a few months and we're like, okay, never mind. We're going to try this again. Only everything is completely different. The plane is now, I mean, I don't know if you've bought a car that's been in an accident. They're just never great again. Okay.
No.
But it's the same plane. It's been fixed up and they're telling her everything's fine. And Manning, one of our navigators, is like, I can't do it anymore. You know, we were supposed to leave in March. Now it's June. His life has changed. So he ducks out. But the good news is the drunky drunkerton, Frank Noonan, not only is he like, I'll still do it, but he's been married and divorced since then.
Wow.
Like he had a rough, for a guy who's already drinking, he's had a rough couple weeks. Yeah.
So I'm left with the plane that's probably got like scraps of a Cessna on the side and also the drunk guy. Sounds like a plan. Let's do it.
Uh-huh. Oh, and also we're going to go the other way now. We're not going to go east to west. We're going to go west to east because the winds have changed and it's a totally different season. And we're going to go the other way around. So Amelia and Fred Noonan get on this busted ass slash fixed up again, Electra E, and they have hand over my heart, chin up to the sky, Fallon. They have a wonderful couple of weeks flying around the world. They go to South America, across the Atlantic to Africa. They go to Ethiopia, across the Red Sea. She hangs out in Karachi for a couple of days. She goes to Singapore. She lands then on Timor Island and hang out there for a while. It's been a few weeks and they get then to this city called Ley, New Guinea.
Oh.
And now guess what? We're going to get to Howland Island. That's the fucking, that dumb fucking island where we were supposed to go when we crashed the first time. It was on the first part of the trip. Now, because we went around the world the other side, we still have to land on that little Pacific island, but it will be one of our last stops before we get home instead of one of our first stops on the way out.
She discussed the hazardous course, which had been plotted for her by Fred Noonan.
Howland Island is a trick. As I said, it doesn't have an airstrip, it is tiny. Okay, this island is 2 miles long and only 3/4 of a mile wide, and its height is 25 feet, which means if it's a cloudy day, it can look like the shadow of a cloud.
Wow, because it's so close to sea level. It's like on the water, basically.
Whew. Right, and we desperately need to land on this because it's the stop we got to land on, or we're going to run out of fuel and crash in the ocean, right? So in order to facilitate helping Amelia land her plane on this tiny little island, a lot of work has been done. G.P. Putnam and the fucking president of the United States has not just made sure it's clear and like made sure she's carrying the right kind of communication equipment. They have ships out there on Howland Island and in between that are there to send her signals, to give her updates on weather, to talk to her, and to listen for her. So there is like a kind of a safety net of like ships so they can spot her and they can help her along the way. And the guy in charge of this is a guy named Commander Thompson of the Itasca. And he's kind of a grumpy cunt. He doesn't love this job. He doesn't want to deal with this woman. It seems like a sideshow. Again, the war is technically, we're not at war yet, but everyone can feel it brewing. And this just seems kind of silly, honestly, a waste of his resources, but it's a job and he's going to do his job. And one of the things he notices as she's approaching Helena, you know, she's going to be flying to his island soon and he's getting all of these ships set up, is he feels like there's too many people. He's confused. He's like, too many people are speaking to her and for her. And he starts to get confused as to like, when exactly should I be looking for her? What kind of radio exactly does she have on board? And G.P. Putnam is telling him something different than the printed information is telling him. And he just goes, you know what? Fuck all that. I'm just going to talk to her. So he sends a message to Ley, New Guinea, where she's going to be leaving from. And he says, you tell me everything you have on board, all of your communication, you know, situation and qualifications. And then tell me 12 hours before you leave.
I can imagine the absolute like pandemonium of having, because I've been on a ship and when a big like event happens, people are talking on everything. Like, there's phones and there's radios. And I can't imagine being in that little plane, like, knowing this landing is your life or literally your death, and having, you know, looking at 15 voices parroting in your ear.
Oh.
Like, I'm glad somebody stepped in.
Right. And he tries. I mean, to your point, he tries his best, you know. And the day that she leaves from Ley, New Guinea, she's already been around the world. This plane has been through it. She's physically exhausted. And it's finally the scheduled day, July 2nd, 1937, 10:22 a.m. Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan take off from New Guinea, headed towards Howland Island. I encourage you to go to YouTube. You can watch it take off. It's kind of an emotional feeling. The radio operator in New Guinea is talking to her and hears her for 7 hours. And then at about the time they would expect her to be sort of out of range, she's out of range. And there's a long period of time where nobody hears from her at all. But again, we're not too concerned because we knew there'd be dead spots, right? But then there's a point where she should have flown over this ship called the Ontario. And this ship is like, boy, howdy, we've been looking. And they're also doing old school shit, like sending up smoke and stuff, like sending out things so that if she's on the horizon, maybe she can spot them if she's using, you know, purely visual. And she misses what they expected, a rendezvous with this ship, at least to have seen her. Then there is a huge storm. A squall rises up and it definitely delays her. It probably ended up using up a ton of her fuel. And nobody hears from her again until 2:45 a.m. on July 3rd. And of course, they're like, oh, thank God. Okay, she's okay. And they hear her, but she clearly cannot hear them because she just keeps saying the same thing, and she's not giving any sort of indication that she's receiving their signals.
Is she saying like a distress signal, or is she just like, they can't really tell?
She is sending out what information she has, the altitude they're flying and what she knows. And she's also telling them, we can't find you. We're looking, we think we should see you, and you probably think you should see us. And they're trying to determine, you know, and again, this is where my engineering is going to fall short. But essentially, what they're up against is frequency and strength. What frequency she could be heard on is different than the frequency she could speak on. And there was miscommunication as to when they were going to be speaking and what kind of abilities her devices had. She also probably fucked up. Pretty much historians agree that there was an essential antenna that was like a 250-foot antenna that essentially, once your plane gets up in the air, you have to manually like unroll so that your devices will work. And she didn't like doing that. And she had either broken it off, like it might have broken off during one of the crashes. But folks, especially folks who have examined all the video, were like, I don't think she even had that antenna. And somebody else was like, yeah, she said she fucking hated unwinding that thing. And, you know, who knows? But we do get at 4:53 a.m., after again another hour of not hearing, they hear she breaks in. They're trying to send her a message, and she breaks in, which makes them know she probably can't hear us. And it's real garbled and it's real distant, and they can't get a fix and they can't get a pin on her. And then she's gone again. And then at 6:14 a.m., she comes in again, and she's louder and clearer, which is great because this indicates she's getting closer. But they still can't get a fix because their frequencies are mismatched, or they can't hear her long enough to get all of the information that they need to actually make the physical determination. And then at 7:42 a.m., she says, I must be close, but I can't see you, and I only have a half hour of fuel left. And at 8 a.m., she acknowledges for the first time that she can hear the Itasca, but she can't find them. And at 8:44 a.m., they get her final transmission, in which they can't make out much of what she says, but her voice is shrill and breathless. And she just keeps saying, I will repeat this message. I will repeat this message. And that is the last they hear. And 23 days before her 40th birthday.
Oh my gosh.
Amelia Earhart disappears.
Oh, I know that I knew it was coming, but as you're telling it, I was like, maybe it's going to turn out different this time. They found her. Like, oh. It's like hard to hear.
I know. You do kind of want your Quentin Tarantino.
Right? Like maybe we were all wrong. Dawn figured it out.
She made it. But no, I'm with you, Fallon. I even reading it, I would turn the page with some bizarre hope, you know? And it must have been the same feeling for the folks who were looking for her, because it was the most extensive mass rescue attempt for a single lost plane ever. 4,000 men, 10 ships, 65 airplanes, 250 square miles of the Pacific, and they found nothing.
Wow.
Into the distant Pacific to join the greatest searching party in the history of aviation.
I would be shocked, especially given the creepy circles you run in. If you have not at least heard some of the conspiracy theories surrounding Amelia Earhart and like what may have happened to her, you may, however, be surprised to know that the first conspiracy theory was actually generated by Hollywood intentionally in an anti-Japanese propaganda film called Flight to Freedom, which is a movie that generally suggests that with President Roosevelt's planning and direction, a female pilot would pretend to go missing in the Pacific so as to infiltrate these small islands and dupe the Japanese into pursuing her. It is an okay movie, I guess, but it is definitely like a breach and also the source, I think, of a lot of the theories that people came up with because they have no actual answers.
Yeah, I think one of the only conspiracy theories I've heard is something along those lines. Like she was actually going to be a military spy. And so she wasn't lost. She was actually like on a mission and spying, but not like her plane didn't actually get lost.
Yeah, it's not a great theory. And there's a lot of other theories too. Like one of the theories is that she just, maybe she wasn't fueled properly. There are some engineers who are like, she was never carrying as much fuel as she should have because they had made a mistake in New Guinea. A lot of historians will fairly appropriately, I think, point the finger at Fred Noonan. You know, yet another drunk who was at the whim of deciding which way to go. He also had some faulty charts. One of the charts that he was using did show the island somewhere like 7 miles away from where it actually was.
Right. She's like, I got drunk Fred on board and he's and he says it's this way. So I think he might be right. Like we'll head that direction. How can we lose?
Every now and again, some archaeologist will successfully sell something to the Travel Channel. You know, is Amelia Earhart found? And there'll be some island that has a piece of shiny metal on it. And they'll be like, yes, this is the metal. There was even a theory that she had faked her death and changed her name and moved to New Jersey. But that put this poor gal too. There's this gal in New Jersey who was like, I am not Amelia Earhart. Wow. I don't know how many times I have to tell you, like, look at my teeth. It's not me. But then most recently, Fallon, you and I are holding an anchor to this story because this year in 2024, a company called Deep Sea Vision, based out of Charleston, South Carolina, that operates some unmanned underwater vehicles, found via sonar what appears to be the remains of an airplane. And it's shaped like that Electra 10E. It's on the ocean floor. It's only about 100 miles away from Howland Island. And they're currently, as we speak, our investigations to either confirm or deny that that's her plane.
Wow. And that could be like a kid. That's like, it's like a Jack the Ripper level mystery solved, you know, like we get to see the resolution of Amelia Earhart in another lifetime. That's amazing.
Amazing. Right. And then I just have to leave you with this nugget because it has had me giggling ever since. So Howland Island, apparently you can visit. It's not exactly a tourist destination. It looks to me like a sandbar that maybe also has a bar on it, but I don't, you know, see it. But they did build on Howland Island a rock kind of formation. It's not a statue. It kind of looks like a monument, but it's called Amelia Rock, and it's a tribute to Amelia Earhart on the island that was, you know, her final destination. And get this, there are Google reviews online of Amelia Rock on Howland Island. There's 6 online reviews of this rock. 5 of them give the rock 5 stars and say things like, that was a nice visit with the kids, or what an excellent place to sit and have a beer, right? There's one person who took the time to leave a 2-star review, but doesn't say anything about it.
It wasn't the rock I was expecting.
Somehow this individual found themselves on one of the remotest islands on the planet, saw Amelia Rock, and then got on the internet and went 2 stars.
2 stars do not recommend visiting a rock, probably. Wow.
We did it. We got behind the controls and we throttled right up.
We did.
Amelia Earhart's anals.
We did. I kind of... You know, if I was a smoking lady, I might need a cigarette after that. That was pretty intense, but whew, that was a good one.
Thanks again to Fallon Mori. Go hear more from her on the fantastic true crime podcast, That's So Fucked Up with Ashley Richards. You can go right now to our show notes and you'll find not only links to their podcast, but specifically the episodes in which I joined the crew for a discussion of cult leader Jim Jones. I know, right? As for us, the next new episode, you are in for the ride of your lives, all right? As we hilf the infamous outlaw Jesse James. Yeah, and I'm joined by porn star and history nerd Ryan Keeley for a MILF-HILF crossover. You're really not going to want to miss. Until then, our theme song was composed and performed by Kat Perkins. A reminder that you can find my sources, links to the books, documentaries, and articles I reference in the summary of this episode, or by emailing us, hilfpodcast@gmail.com, or messaging us on social media, @HILF Podcast. This has been HILF. History I'd Like to Fuck with Dawn Brody. I'm Dawn Brody, reminding you that history is a party and everybody's coming.